Want to welcome everybody to the House Judiciary Committee. We're apologizing for the late start. We had a longer floor session today than normal. And just so you understand, we're going to be running up until sometime around 3:30, I hope, when all the members are due back on the floor for a continuation of the floor session. We'll be reconvening then at 6 o'clock this evening to finish up the balance of the agenda. The chair has had a number of requests to try to take bills based on people's schedules and travel needs and everything else. I'm going to do the best I can to accommodate that in line with the other commitments that were made to parties about when we would take bills in order today, and we're just going to try to muddle through it as best we can. That being said, I'm going to ask that everybody, given the length of the schedule and the need for so many people who want to get out of here and not have to come back at 6 o'clock this evening with the rest of us, that you limit your testimony and narrow it to the greatest degree possible. And we want to hear what you have to say, but once somebody in your group has said it to us, you don't necessarily need to repeat the same thing to us again. And so it would really expedite the work of the committee if we could address matters in that way. With that in mind, we're going to jump down to late-breaking news. Okay. Thank you. All right. We are going to jump down on the agenda to try to address this issue first by opening a work session on House Bill 3356, and I'm going to open that work session, and then we should have a list of witnesses that Patsy is now handing me. Thank you. In panels, I'm going to ask for Detective Brian Gross from the City of Portland, Roy Thorpe, and Dennis Mulvihill from Washington County to come forward. And I don't see Dennis.
He's on.
Okay. And why don't we go ahead and start with Ms. Thorpe.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, my name is Roe Thorpe. I'm the Executive Director of Basic Rights Oregon. I'm here today representing our organization, which includes about 65,000 supporters statewide, and our mission is to end discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity in our state. I'll go very quickly. I wanted to let you know that the bill before you today that amends our state intimidation laws would make us the 8th state to do so. The other states are Minnesota, Missouri, California, Pennsylvania, Vermont, New Mexico, and Hawaii. And I wanted to talk to you specifically about a murder that you will probably hear more about. And I actually don't want to forget to turn in my copies of these. And that is the murder of Lonnie Okoruru. She was a Hillsborough resident and a Loa resident who was murdered in August of 2001. And she was a transgendered woman, the victim of a bias crime, murdered because of her gender identity. Her murder is still unsolved, and in the packets that you're being given, there's actually more details about that murder. It was particularly brutal murder, and it was something that was sort of the extreme version of what many transgendered people faced every single day. I wanted to let you know that particular murder had a huge impact on the transgender community. I have met people all across the state who are afraid to leave their homes. They're afraid to do the daily kind of tasks that most of us take for granted, to get groceries, to, you know, go to a restaurant, to meet friends, to walk places. That has become something that is not safe for them. And District Attorney Bob Herman couldn't be here today. I believe that the gentleman from Multnomah County is going to read his testimony. But on behalf of him and Detective Mike O'Connell, who both worked on the on the Okaruru case in Hillsborough, I wanted to tell you that I talked to both of them this morning, and they were both incredibly moved by that particular case and found it to be much worse than what they're accustomed to seeing even, which is a lot. They're accustomed to seeing a lot. And the most shocking thing to them was that when they were investigating this particular murder, they received a handful of calls from people telling them not to investigate it, that they should not be using taxpayers' money and their time to investigate this murder. And this was the only time that either of them can ever remember citizens actually taking the time to call up and tell them not to investigate a murder, which for both of them spoke to the level of hate that was out there in the community. And they felt that that was remarkable and would have commented on it themselves had they been able to attend today. I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and I'll turn the floor over.
Thank you, Ms. Thorpe. Detective Gross?
Chair Williams, members of the House Judiciary Committee, my name is Brian Gross. I'm a detective with the Portland Police Bureau. I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak before your committee. As a Portland police detective, I find it imperative for adding gender identity to the bias crime statutes, the intimidation statutes, for three main reasons. One is members of the transgender community are highly visible and highly targeted. They're not currently protected adequately by the state law as it is, and due to the high cost to our society regarding transgender issues. My duties include specifically investigating crimes of hate. I'm assigned to that full time, along with being an assault detective. In my experience, transgender people often have speech patterns, mannerisms, and clothing preferences that of the opposite sex of which they belong, and they are highly visible and highly targeted by a number of people. During my tenure as the bias crime detective, I've had the opportunity to investigate cases concerning assaults of people of transgender nature. I believe they're not adequately protected by our laws as they stand right now. Currently, laws are such that not being included, if I were to walk up to a transgender person and spit on them because of the way they're dressed or the way they looked at the time, that would simply be a misdemeanor. If I were to ruin their property, that would be a misdemeanor, depending on the value of the property, obviously. If I were to assault them with my fist, once again, that would just be an assault for. That would really not reflect the reason why the crime was perpetrated. An intimidation charge in a record would indicate the fact that they are hateful. It was a hateful crime rather than just a explained away by spitting on somebody or slapping somebody. Lastly, the cost to our society, especially the victims of this current situation, is high. I believe people are shunned and ostracized and actually attacked due to the way they look. It's something they can't control is makes it they can't develop their potential to be productive and reliable contributors to community. There's impairment in social and occupational areas of functioning. In addition, criminals who are not given a sufficient penalty and motivation to desist tend to repeat their actions, and it may cause a negative ramification even if their actual numbers may be small in cases. Thank you for affording me the opportunity to testify on behalf of Bill 3356. I hope you will support it. I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Gross. Detective Mr. Mulvihill, you're here as a substitute for District Attorney Herman, is that right?
That's correct. Dennis Mulvihill, Washington County Government Affairs. Bob Herman, the DA for Washington County, asked me to have this read into the record. I believe you have a copy of it. It's very brief. I'll read it quickly. I apologize that I could not appear in person as planned, but recent developments in the murder case in our county over the last 20 hours require my presence in Hillsborough. I'm writing to lend my support of House Bill 3356. The bill proposes to add gender identity to the intimidation laws, crimes often referred to as hate crimes. My support of the bill as a district attorney arises from the ongoing investigation of a murder case in our county. The victim was a transgendered person. Although unsolved, the investigators strongly believe the murder was motivated by the gender identity of the victim. The investigation has revealed previous assaults against the victim because of gender identity. The intentional killing of another human being without lawful excuse, certainly by definition, is a senseless act. The killing of human beings because of a lifestyle is utterly senseless as well. This bill would acknowledge that senselessness. This bill does not endorse a lifestyle or grant a special status to certain individuals. It does, however, address a very real issue we have experienced in Washington County. Over my years as a prosecutor, I have seen and or personally prosecuted crimes against persons based solely on race, color, national origin, or sexual orientation. This bill would simply ensure that individuals targeted for crimes solely because of gender identity will have the same protection as others do now under the intimidation laws. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Mulvihill. Are there questions for the panel? Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate it. The next panel, I'm probably going to get this wrong. I'll just, Amelia, you can tell us what your last name is when you get up here. I'm not going to try to butcher it in front of everybody for you. David Dornack and Damon Woodcock. Whenever you're ready, Amelia.
Thank you, Chair Williams and members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Amalia Alarcón Gaddy, and I'm the manager of the Metropolitan Human Rights Center for the City of Portland.
I'm really glad I did that.
There won't be a quiz at the end.
I'm going to test the committee. You all have to try to spell her name right at the end of her testimony.
I'm here today in support of House Bill 3356. I've had the privilege of working with both the City of Portland and Multnomah County to create and amend civil rights ordinances that are inclusive of sexual orientation and gender identity. In doing so, I had the opportunity to hear the stories of people who are members of my community and yet are not afforded the right to live their lives in peace or safety, all because certain people, hostile and at times violent people, perceive that their appearance is not what it should be. Because of this, I come before you to testify about this House bill. All person crimes are heinous and traumatic. According to a National Gay and Lesbian Task Force study, victims of hate crime suffer 2 to 3 times more physical trauma than victims of any other crimes. Additionally, hate crimes have the added impact of terrorizing not just the direct victim, but also the entire community to which they belong. When working on Portland's local ordinance, I received comments referring to transgender people as unacceptable, subhuman, and weirdos. I received threatening anonymous notes and messages about how I was headed for the fires of hell and how the senders would be happy to help me get there. All of this hostility was directed at me simply because I was supporting policy work of the city and the county on this issue. This, more than anything, gave me a small glimpse of what life might be like for a transgender person. The fact that this generated so much hostility and people felt such permission to speak about it so abusively, even violently, just validated my conviction that there is an urgent need to create strong legal deterrence to the abuse faced daily by trans people in our community. During our process for collecting testimony, a homeless trans person said, "A man came over and started to talk to me, asking if I would sleep with him. I told him that I did not do that, and he hit me and broke my nose. I gave the police information about my attacker, but they didn't pay attention, and I sometimes see that person around like nothing happened. My experience has been that people treat me like I am an animal." Too many cases such as this go unreported and uninvestigated. Our silence on this matter as a state makes us complicit in the violence. I thank you all for giving me the opportunity to offer testimony, and I urge you to please send a strong message that crimes motivated by bigotry will not be tolerated in Oregon. Would be happy to answer any questions if you have some.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dornack.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is David Dornack. I am pastor in the Presbyterian Church USA. I moved to Oregon in 1999 from Iowa, America's heartland. I am the fourth head of staff to serve Rose City Park Presbyterian Church in Portland since 1909. I have 3 grown children and 4 young grandchildren. And I'm here this afternoon because of two women, PJ and Annette. Annette, who served on a worship committee and each summer plays her bagpipes for us as we celebrate our Scottish heritage. And PJ, formerly Peter John, a retired business owner who had her gender reassignment surgery 4 years ago and remains married to her wife, Gail, of 42 years in a committed monogamous marriage. With prayerful consideration, since I care and value both of these women, I came to believe that it is imperative that my voice be added to other voices to speak up in changing what might have been an oversight or else an injustice. I am in support of adding the category of gender identity to the Oregon intimidation law. It was reported in a national study that 60% of transgender individuals have been victims of violence, with nearly 50% requiring medical care. It's estimated that each month, one transgendered person is murdered. The violence toward those who are different must cease. And if adding gender identity helps those in law enforcement and the legal system to deal with perpetrators who prey on those who are different, then I believe this is a necessary change. I seek to follow the example of the one I serve. I recall that it was my Lord who stunned his friends and followers by reaching out to the marginalized of his day. He also welcomed at his table those who are different, the poor, the religiously unorthodox, the sinners, prostitutes, and tax collectors. I also believe that in this day and in this time, each one of us here are challenged, each of us to let go of and to move beyond discomfort and fear of those who are different and open our hearts and lives and arms to the beautiful, multifaceted, and multicultural diversity of creation. You know, since my arrival in Portland, my 22-year-old son often reminds me by saying, "Dad, you're not in Iowa anymore." Yeah, it's true. But I am glad I'm in Oregon, because it's in this place that I've been challenged and my eyes and my heart have been opened, because what was once only a word, transgender, has for me become embodied and alive by PJ and Annette, as they have shared with me their fears, their struggles, their stories of deep faith. I think our congregation is richer because of both of them, and if in some measure they can be more comfortable walking down a neighborhood street or out to their car after a service of worship or a committee meeting and not be limited in the living of their daily lives due to fear or harassment or even violence, then what we've done today will be good and it will be just. You know, I taught my children that diversity is really God's good idea, that the person who is different is God's gift to you. So I leave that thought with you today, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to come before you. I urge you to support House Bill 3356, and I'd be happy to answer any questions which you might have.
Thank you, Pastor Dornack. Mr. Woodcock.
Good afternoon, Chair Williams and members of the committee. My name is Damon Woodcock, and I'm here today to ask you to support House Bill 3356, adding gender identity to Oregon's hate crime laws, and to relate to you my personal experiences as a trans person. I'm a medically retired police officer, and during my 16 years with the Portland Police Bureau, I investigated numerous incidents involving harassment and assaults against transgendered individuals. I personally know many transgendered people who have been verbally harassed and seriously physically assaulted simply because they are transgendered. I transitioned from female to male while on the job at the police bureau. Shortly after moving into the men's locker room at the direction of the chief, my locker was vandalized by unknown male co-workers, and I became the victim of a hate crime. This act of vandalism was directed at me specifically due to my sexual orientation as well as my transgendered status. The vandalism consisted of a circle with a slash through it drawn over a portion of my name tag on the locker. The message came across loud and clear: "No cock, no woodcock, we don't want you here." That message was clearly meant to intimidate me into moving out of the locker room. I later learned that derogatory comments regarding faggots and dykes, as well as the comment, quote, "a vagina should not be in the penis locker room," unquote, were openly being made in the locker room prior to the act of vandalism. The crime reports document that I was described by male coworkers as being, quote, "disgusting," unquote, and, quote, "morally wrong," unquote. What I experienced in the workplace pales in comparison to being seriously assaulted or killed. On average, one transgendered person a month is murdered in the United States simply because they are trans. In conclusion, it is time for us as a society to recognize and stop the violence being perpetrated against the trans community. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you, Mr. Woodcock. Are there questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. Last panel, Andrea Meyer and Lori Buckwalder. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Williams and members of the committee. My name is Lori Buckwalter, and I have served as the Executive Director of It's Time Oregon for the last 7 years. We educate and advocate for the gender identity rights of all Oregonians and all Americans, and I speak in total support of provisions of HB 3356 to add gender identity to the definition of bias crimes under Oregon law. As an executive director of a civil rights organization, I have many experiences with the political arguments and the statistics that one can apply to this situation, but I'd like to speak to you primarily from my personal experience. The sense of permission for the abuse of gender minorities is still widespread in this culture. My family and I have been repeated subjects of verbal abuse and threats, and I have been sexually assaulted because of my gender identity. I have had people try to run their cars off the road at me while I was jogging, who have followed me with video recorders in their cars while they shouted insults at me, and I have feared to travel outside my own neighborhood at times. During this time, I have heard similar stories of attacks from other transgender people. As an advocate for trans rights, I am familiar with the arguments around these issues, and I am familiar with the variety of opinions that people have when they speak publicly about this. But last year, when I was engaged in an effort to do public education about gender identity and trans issues, I was a guest on a local talk show on the radio. During the course of this show, the host was intent on diverting the attention of the audience away from my concerns for the safety of people in the community to presumptions about some threats that I might pose to them. After I left the air, I continued to listen as the host elicited and encouraged listeners to call in with their expressions of disgust about people like me and the prospects of their encountering transgender people in public space. The resulting calls included promises to inflict physical violence on transgendered people. I was sickened and downhearted to hear this invective, but it is not atypical. I mention this incident to you not in an effort to control people's freedom of speech, but because it is so typical of the types of violence and the threats of violence that we face as people whose gender identity is different in this culture. As these people on the radio speak of violence to others solely on the basis of their gender identity, others in our community walk in fear of that very violence, including people in my family. They are waiting for your voice of leadership, of true human compassion, and an expression of the fairness to all that is our heritage. And they are waiting for the clear message from you to them and for the rest of the state that it is not okay to hate people just because of their gender identity. Hate crimes against any person make that allowed to stand unchallenged, threaten that person and others like them, and they threaten the social fabric that we rely on for our safety, all of us. No penalty can erase the terror that a victim feels for a lifetime. Nothing will bring back dead transgendered people. But I ask you to give me and others like me the hope that someday we will live in this state without looking over our shoulder. I once asked my partner what it was like for her when I left in public, even just to go around a corner. And she told me simply, "Every time I hold my breath." We have held our breath for so long, and we want to breathe the air of this world. Please help to remove the poison of hatred from this air. Thank you very much, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, we are pleased to testify in support of this House bill. This is the kind of classification of which there is plentiful evidence that you've heard today. The individuals are being targeted for violence, and it is appropriate to add this category to the Oregon law. It's appropriate for our state to reflect the heightened seriousness with which we treat criminals' acts that also constitute invidious discrimination and deprive people of their rights to lawfully participate in society. We believe the enhancement of punishment is permissible because these crimes convey a constitutionally unprotected threat against the use of public places by members of targeted groups. Briefly, I want to touch on the history with the ACLU and this law. The first intimidation law, which was approved in 1981 by this body, we opposed it. We opposed it on constitutional grounds because it was directed at expression and political views of the defendant. The bill was approved, and wouldn't you know, the ACLU filed an amicus brief on a number of cases. And we prevailed. The court held it was unconstitutional. But we didn't stop there. In next section, in response, the ACLU drafted the current law to cure the constitutional defect. We then filed an amicus brief in the challenge, Plowman, where the Oregon Supreme Court upheld the law. We believe that the new law provides the necessary safeguards to assure expressive and associational rights are not infringed. And when the court addressed the issue, they both dealt with Article 1, Section 8, the Free Expression, and the Privileges and Immunity Clause, Article 1, Section 20. Now, I just want to close in saying it's important to understand that this law does not protect just certain groups in Oregon, but it protects all Oregonians. A person can be singled out because of their race, regardless of whether they are white, black, Latino. Same with sexual orientation. It does not matter what the sexual orientation of the person is, but that the attack was motivated on that. It protects white-on-white crime as much as it protects white-on-black or black-on-white crime. So we urge you to add this important new category to the law to further protect all Oregonians. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Are there questions for either of these witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony today. We appreciate all of you coming down and informing the committee. I'm now going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3356. Colleagues, we're next going to move up on the agenda towards the top. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3338. Again, in the interest of accommodating people's schedules, Representative Krummel, do you want to take the witness stand, and then I assume Ms. Lester is with you, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Lester, if you'd want to come up as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little sideline coaching going on here. For the record, I'm State Representative Jerry Krummel, House District 26, and I bring to you House Bill 3338. This bill was originally brought to me, the idea for this bill was brought to me by a constituent of mine, Michelle Lester, and she's here next to me. And the purpose is to make sure that custodial parents in divorce-type situations family breakups don't stand in the way of non-custodial parents being able to see their children, and then taking the children and having a new partner adopt the child, or a new spouse adopt the child. In addition, what I would like for the committee to consider are the Dash 1 amendments. It changes the original bill slightly in that it puts the one-year restriction that's in the bill that has been taken out. It puts it back in and inserts language that would allow the court to consider whether whether the custodial parent has attempted without good cause to prevent or to impede contact between a child and the parent whose parental rights would be terminated under a section under the section later, which would be in an action under this section, and that is to with regards to adoption by a second spouse. In addition, the Dash 1 amendments have Section 2, and I think Robin Pope is here, and she will address those issues, but it has to do with adoption of in a adults type situation, and I will I would rather she go ahead and address those issues, but I wanted to let the committee know that I am in support of the Dash 1 amendments, both for the reasons in Section 1 as well as for the reasons in Section 2 with regards to adult adoption. And with that, I'm going to cut off my comments and turn it over to Michelle Lester, who is going to make some brief comments, and then we can move on. And I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Lester.
Hi. I sit here before you today, a broken woman. I have lost a lot last year. My mother died October 23rd, and my son was, I'm no longer his legal parent as of August 22nd. Because Oregon law does not clearly define and protect non-custodial parents, I am a victim of the present statute as it stands now. I am, in speaking with Mrs. Pope, willing to withdraw my original bill and support her proposed amendment to House Bill 338, and over the next 2 years we will keep tweaking this step-parent adoption, and that's fine. All I wanted to say was, when in Oregon statutes where it says incidental contact may not be considered by the court, which means, you know, hey, she's had some contact but hasn't been consistent and hasn't been every day, and, you know, that really hurts non-custodial parents who have tried to have contact, who have tried to go through the custodial parents, who get shot down, who get humiliated, talked to like dirt, get listened to on the telephone. Their children get told that we're going to kidnap them and we're not going to bring them back, and we have to go through this year after year. It gets real tiring, and you just figure, hey, I need to let this child go for a while, let him grow up a little bit, let him have some sort of stability, and then try to re-embark on my relationship. In Oregon law, you can't do that. In the statute, the way it stands now, if you go 1 year, that's it. You're no longer considered a parent. And the part that I like about this amendment is they're used to say, even if the other parent makes it difficult for the non-custodial parent, is still not good enough reason why the NCP would stop contact. Well, the way it's amended, it takes that out. And it puts some responsibility on the custodial parent to say, hey, we need to look at them and see, what are they doing? You know, they were contacting, now the contact is over. Why? So I agree with it, and I support it, and I would like for you to support it as well. It's a good step. It's not by any means the finish line, but I believe it's a good start. Had this bill been the way it is, amended now, I think I would still be, I'd have my son today.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Lester. Are there questions for Ms. Lester? We have several other witnesses signed up to testify on the bill, but I want to make sure that we have an opportunity to address questions. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. We appreciate you coming down. Thank you, Representative Crummel. Next up, why don't we bring up Robin Pope, Kathy, and I'm not going to get your Ledesma. Sorry. I finally figured it out just as I was trying to read it, Kathy. Why don't we hold right there? Is there anybody else with you two? Then we'll bring up the next panel right after that.
Good afternoon, Chair Williams and members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Robin Pope. I'm an attorney in private practice. I'm the chairperson of the Oregon State Bar Standing Committee on Adoption, and I'm a member of the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys. I appreciate the chance to be here. I have written testimony. I'm not going to repeat that, I hope, at least not in its entirety. And I would ask that my statement be submitted for the record, Chair Williams. I appreciate Ms. Lester's willingness to compromise and to be willing to work with me and with Representative Crummell. We just started doing this late last week, so it's been kind of a flurry of activity. I was very concerned about House Bill 3338 as originally written, but with the amendments we've come up with, I think it actually will strengthen Oregon law in this area. There are two sets of amendments. The first are the ones that concern Ms. Lester more. I would ask that you support those and that we leave the one-year period in 109.324. Quite frankly, if we took it out, we might have a constitutional problem because in the juvenile code, it's a six-month period for termination of parental rights when a parent has deserted or neglected their child. So we have a distinction between juvenile termination cases and private adoptions. I think one of the fixes that we can do and that Ms. Lester and I are committed to working together on over the next 2 years is to codify the court-appointed right to counsel to make sure that birth parents whose rights could be terminated under 109.324 have notice of that right to counsel. So we're going to be working on that, and I will probably approach Representative Crummell, if you wouldn't mind, and work with him on it. In terms of the Section 2 of the proposed amendments, that regards adult adoptions, and I was asked to help draft this amendment by Judge Rita Cobb in Washington County, who has had discussions with several other judges in the state of Oregon, Judge Claudia Burton here in Marion County, Judge Betsy Welch, presiding judge in Multnomah County, Judge Maureen McKnight, and Judge Lowe in Clackamas County. What these judges are seeing are instances where adults are petitioning to adopt other adults, typically a caregiver with whom they have a very nominal relationship. And the judges are saying it smells. It doesn't pass the sniff test, but we don't think under the current statutory scheme we can do anything about it. And we want a procedure. We want a process so that if a case like this comes before us and we suspect that there's some form of elder abuse occurring, which is what this in essence would be, we want a way to look into it. And so Judge Cobb and I drafted Section 2. We tried to make sure that there was no fiscal impact on the state of Oregon, that the costs of these additional requirements would be or could be apportioned. Actually, they shall be. It's not could be. It shall be apportioned between the petitioner and the adult person asking to be adopted. So we don't believe there's a fiscal impact. The judges support this. Judge Cobb has had several cases, and she asked me to just briefly advise you of that fact, where she's been very concerned there's elder fraud or duress, and just through circumstances, one of them went away, but one of them didn't. And it created quite an issue with family members and different issues like that. I could go on and on, probably, but I know that you're short on time, and so I would welcome questions at this point, and also Ms. Ledesma's here to address her concerns.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and take Ms. Ledesma's concerns, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you. Thank you. For the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma. I'm the program manager for adoptions at the Oregon Department of Human Services. And I am here today. I came prepared to testify in opposition to House Bill 3338. You have my prepared written testimony in front of you. Many of the points that I've addressed in that testimony are now moot points if that original bill, that language is withdrawn. I do, however, want to go on record as saying that we were opposing the bill for a different reason, and that is because the removal of that 1 year, the effect that that would have on independent infant adoptions in the state of Oregon, and frequently we run into situations in which birth fathers have their babies hidden from them or don't have access to those children. So for that reason, we were going to oppose the bill. In regard to the amendments, we would support the amendments having to do with the adoption of minors. And so the amendments in Section lines 1 through 15. I am not prepared, nor am I qualified, to speak to Section 2 and Section 3, or actually the remainder of the bill, having to do with adult adoptions. And when I realized that probably we would be talking about the amendments as well as the actual bill, I did do a call back to our legislative liaison back at the office and was hoping that someone from seniors and people with disabilities would be here to address concerns, because that those amendments really are in the purview of that section of DHS.
So I want to make sure I still understood you, Kathy. Even with the amendments, lines 1 through 15, you're still in opposition to the bill. You're not in opposition to the bill.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, no.
Okay.
We are not opposing the sections of the bill as amended having to do with the adoption of minors and not taking a position on the seniors.
All right, good.
Thank you.
Got to keep my scorecard straight here.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Are there questions for either Ms. Pope or Ms. Ledesma? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you for giving us a chance to be here.
You bet. Thank you, Ms. Pope. Jason Penny and Scott Adams. Whichever one of you wants to go first.
Hello, Chair Williams. My name is Jason Penny, and I am a former single parent in Washington County, Oregon. And you have your written testimony that I've submitted. I'd like that to be made part of the public record. In light of Ms. Lester's comments, a lot of what I was going to discuss today is indeed moot. I, too, support the Dash 1 amendments as they've been proposed to the committee today. All I'd like to add to that is I come from the other side, where I've had to rebuild a family after having a mother abandoning my children. And the existing law, and especially with the Dash 1 amendments that strengthen it, is one of the factors that allowed my wife to claim my two children as her own. And I think that adoption, you should keep in mind that it's for the benefit of the children. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the brevity of your testimony. Mr. Adams.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Scott Adams. I'm a sole practitioner in Northwest Oregon. My practice focuses on adoption, building of families, and the protection of birth parents' rights. I often represent people that are in Ms. Lester's positions, and my heart absolutely goes out to her. I was opposed to the original 3338. I am strongly in favor of the Dash 1 amendments. I'd like to point out that 109.324, as it stands and as it would stand under the Dash 1 amendments, does give very strong protections to birth parents who have been gone to be able to provide a reason for that absence. And if that reason is sufficient to knock away the standard of clear and convincing evidence, so it doesn't take much for them to be able to attack that clear and convincing standard, they do have strong rights. What we have with Ms. Lester's case is a case of one case gone bad, that the law that exists under the Dash 1 amendments and currently now very likely could have been better used to protect her. And I will be working with Ms. Pope and with Ms. Lester to go on and make stronger supports for that. But I am here in favor of the Dash 1 amendments and would stand on the written testimony with regard to anything else. I am available at any time to any of the representatives for any questions. My phone numbers and addresses are in my written testimony.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there questions for either of these witnesses? Thank you very much. It sounds like the Dash 1 amendments generally have broad support. Is there anybody else here to testify on House Bill 3338? Okay. I do have a note from the court. They have, having not had a chance from the administrative side, I understand judges were involved, to review the amendments, they need to determine whether or not there is a possibility of a fiscal, and I suspect it's the second portion of the bill. It's the elder abuse review piece that may have some issues on a fiscal. So what I'm going to ask that we do is we'll set this for early next week for a work session to give the court an opportunity to run the fiscal. If let me just ask with a show of hands, sort of doing this on the fly from those who testified. Obviously, the stuff that you, Ms. Pope, worked out with those judges is of interest to the committee. If, however, it comes with a substantial fiscal associated with it and we had to strip it out, would people still support the dash ones only to the extent that it dealt with sort of the main section of the bill?
At the risk of speaking for everyone else, I'd say yes, Chair.
Okay. So if we have to take that out because of a fiscal, it doesn't necessarily have to extinguish the original purpose of the bill.
That's correct. And I would just ask that if I could work with the court administrator's office to discuss the issue of fiscal impact, I'd be happy to do that.
And I'd
do it until Monday.
You bet. And I'd be very encouraging of you to do it. In fact, if you guys, when we're done, want to step out in the hall and sort of make arrangements for how that could happen. We don't have a lot of time on House bills, so they either sort of need to fly with their own wings or they're going to crash here.
Right, and I understand, and my apology is that I'm flying out later this afternoon for a conference out of state, and I already deferred my plane flight once.
The committee does appreciate you. And knowing that you have a plane to catch, we wanted to get you up and out of
Thank
here as quickly
much.
As we could today.
Thanks to all of you.
All right. So with that, then, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3338 and ask counsel to work with Representative Crummell and Ms. Pope and the courts to ensure where that's going. So next, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2590. Counsel, do you want to bring us up to speed on that one? And I think that's Counsel Joseph, isn't it?
It is. There is dash 1 through 3 amendments that I received just recently that I understand come from Representative Ackerman, and I hoped he might be able to explain them. This bill, if you recall, deals with real estate broker liens. We dealt with a similar issue last week on liens for land surveyors. This, again, deals with the issue of real estate brokers who are not paid following the closing of a real estate deal. If I recall, the original bill only applies to commercial properties.
Okay. Representative Ackerman, you have some amendments, and why don't I ask Ms. Jarvis... and you brought, I think, a witness with you. If you want to come up, and we can talk about Representative Ackerman's amendments. Representative Ackerman, you want to tell us what your amendments do?
Yes, I think they read very simply. The dash one would shorten the time for filing a lien from 90 days to 45 days. Dash two shortens a period of time from 2 years to 120 days for the commencement of the foreclosure suit. And the dash 3 amendments would apply the bill only to transactions involving a lease and not a sale.
Okay. Ms. Jarvis.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jana Jarvis with the Oregon Association of Realtors. We met with Representative Ackerman. He did brief me that he was going to drop these amendments, and I've just looked at them over lunch today. I think the underlying message I would want to leave with you is that the intention with House Bill 2590 is to create more of a velvet glove than a sledgehammer. And so one of the reasons that we had put a little longer time period was to allow more opportunity for negotiating up front. Representative Prozanski had asked me to look into the states that had commercial broker lien laws in existence, to look at the time frames of the filing of the lien, and how many days it took to, or you know, the period of time to execute. And so you can see really a very broad range of period of time. We had selected 2 years. I think that question was asked of us last time, and I was a little uncertain as to why. I think it was because we modeled it after another bill that had come out last session and after some model legislation that we had seen. We are willing to negotiate on that. We're willing to look at the amendments. I just wanted you to understand the reason for the time periods as they were initially placed.
Okay. Are there questions for either Representative Ackerman or Ms. Jarvis about the amendments? Just doing a comparison, just on the sheet that was passed out, it does seem like from going to 90 to 45 would make it probably shorter than most of the states, and the 120-day on the execution would make it shortest than most of the states. Representative Ackerman, I just sort of throw that out for my own...
I didn't do any comparison with states, Mr. Chairman, because I felt that the testimony that I found persuasive during the public hearing was the fact that it would take too long to process these liens, and it's in the best interest of all parties to not only negotiate to a settlement, but to release the property from lien status. So that was really my motive for shortening the time periods. On the Dash 2 amendments, going to 120 days is consistent with the time period in ORS 87 with respect to the foreclosure time allowed for construction liens and material amendments liens. And that's the guide I used, was to bring that more in sync with our existing lien law.
And I actually did misspeak. It looks like Connecticut has a 6-month period to file and then a 45-day period in which to execute, which seems almost the inverse of what everybody else has. That's sort of interesting.
Well, Mr. Chair, I did not double-check the research that was made for me, so I hope that's correct.
Right.
But I think you see a general pattern. I think the other thing that might be helpful for you on the Dash 3 amendments that Representative Ackerman introduced, it discusses limiting it to leasing. And I brought Mr. Gene Bentley, who was here a couple of weeks ago when we had the original testimony, to kind of speak to that because he does transactions in both leasing and sales. And I think he can more clearly define why we have included sales in this particular piece of legislation.
Okay, Mr. Bentley.
Thank you, Chair Williams, committee members. In a set of circumstances where you have a lease transaction that includes an option to purchase downstream, it would be very helpful to continue to include sale transactions, because what happens is once that lease is in process, the broker's off doing brokerage business, and they don't continue to monitor to make sure that that sale is triggered. And sometimes they get triggered and they don't get paid. And it would be very helpful for us to be able to file a lien on it that deals with sale environment and the lease environment. It is predominantly in the sale world, but there are situations where you find that a option to purchase gets exercised and you don't get paid.
Mr. Bentley, I didn't ask you to identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. I'm Gene Bentley. I'm a commercial broker from Portland, Oregon.
Great.
I'm sorry.
No, it's not your fault. It was my fault. Are there questions? Representative Prezanti.
Mr. Chair, and I'm torn on this bill, and I've met with the proponents and opponents I don't know how many times, and this is the first time I look at the amendments. I keep coming back as to what we need to do to make certain that there is what I would consider a balanced playing field and making sure everyone can have these things adjudicated. My biggest concern right now is I still hear that we're going to allow for a lien to be filed. What their opponents have said, and I'm asking if the proponents can rebut this for me, is that it basically puts them in a position that then whoever has the mortgage is going to give notice to default. I'm wondering if we can't have, let's call it somewhat of a win-win, by allowing for contractual agreements for mandatory arbitration, which would get you into a judicial, quasi-judicial arena to have these decisions litigated that could be a legitimate issue, and then have the ability for a lien to be actually entered based on that decision of the arbitrator. I understand, especially in Portland, that the court system, it takes this way too long, and that there is potentially the need to, let's say, cut your losses and take whatever may be offered to you. And I'm trying to figure a way, because it seems to me what we have before us right now may be shifting it to the other side of where there's more imbalance the opposite way, and I'm trying to see if we can't balance it. So I would ask if you could respond to some of the questions or issues that have been raised by the opponents regarding default notices and not being able to actually have stuff decided because they have to clear the lien or they stand to lose or have the note called.
Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, I can't speak with a great deal of authority about how debtors view this, but having been in this business for nearly 25 years, it's been my experience that most debtors, the last thing they want to do is to own the property. That places a great deal of burden on them. They generally have to dispose of the property if they're going to, in fact, initiate default and take the property back. So while they certainly have a right to do so, I don't think that they very often exercise that right. So in that regard, it's kind of a hollow threat. In a situation where the building owner has negotiated with us in a listing agreement and agreed to pay us a specific fee, and then we go out and do the work and have completed the work, and they have an opportunity all through that process to approve or disapprove of either a sale, if you were doing a sale, or the lessee, they have plenty of opportunities to say no to the deal all the way along. And they've already agreed to the fee. It's what happens is they agree to the fee, they agree to the deal, and then post-deal, they want to change.
Mr. Chair, if I could, the other question I had was, do you think it would be workable for the proponents, for the brokers, to be able to have the ability to have mandatory arbitration with the ability to file a lien based on that decision to expedite this matter and still be before a judicial or quasi-judicial body to determine any?
Excuse me. Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, it's been my experience that most arbitrators start with a idea of how do we get the two polar points together, and generally the two polar points are somewhere in the middle, which is essentially what you have right now when you agree to a fee up front and then you say, okay, I'm going to go do this work and I'm going to do the lease as it is currently envisioned that it would be lease work. I go out and I do all the lease, I do all of the work to provide an acceptable tenant to the landlord, and then he wants to cut the fee. Well, both instances give you the same results, whether you go through arbitration and end up with half a fee or you start out and you have the threat of litigation and you negotiate to half a fee. In either instance, that's half a fee of what you originally thought you were going to do and the original carrot that was held out to you to say, here, if you do this, I will give you this. So you start out with the idea that you're going to have a specific fee in mind and you go and put your time and energy and work and effort into it and produce results, and then ultimately it gets cut.
Mr. Chair, just a clarification. My example was calling regarding arbitration versus mediation. Are you saying in arbitration as compared to mediation you're seeing this? Because to me there are two different worlds.
Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, I'm sorry, but to my view, it's kind of a common world. It is something less than what you originally set out to do, and the original carrot that you had in front of you says, I'm going to pay you a fee of X if you do this job. And you do the job, and it's to their satisfaction, and they have the opportunity to change, and then they want to make it less than X.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In talking to the opponents of this bill, they're saying that oftentimes there's a dispute over the whole reason is a dispute over what was the service provided. You have a contract, and then they say that the service wasn't provided, and if we go ahead and approve this bill, then you can provide less than what was, do a sloppy job, get it through, and then say, and then you argue about the amount owed because they don't think you fulfilled your contract. But then you are able to lien them and then have an unfair advantage.
Chair Williams, Representative Barker. In most, and we're focused now on leases, and I'm going to address leases specifically. In most leases, it spells out the dollar amount that is going to be paid by the tenant. It typically spells out the square footage of the tenant's space, the duration of the lease. And those are the components that we use to develop the fee amount, and it's generally a percentage of the aggregate amount of the lease itself. And aggregate amount means that what's the annual rate times the number of years that it's going to run for. So those are pretty clear and concise amounts, and they're pretty hard to find issue with. I mean, if it's $100 a month times 12 months times 5 years, and it's 5% of that, that's pretty easy math for anybody, and it's hard to say, well, but what happens is they want to negotiate, and it's not the math that they're over. There's some other set of circumstances that comes up. I can't afford to it. I had to pay more TIs. Well, they approved the lease up front. They knew that they were going to commit to the tenant improvements, TIs, excuse me, or tenant improvements that are utilized to build in the tenant into the landlord's space. They commit to those up front in the lease. So they know what they're doing when they sign the lease, and in turn, the tenant signs the lease. So they've got a completed deal.
Follow up, if I may.
You may.
Another thing they said was sometimes there's multiple realtor agents involved, and that's what throws these into a fix. But I'm not sure how that would happen or how that would work.
Representative Williams, Representative Barker, there is a broker who is responsible to the landlord, and they have a cooperative agreement, sometimes written, sometimes just out of tradition, to share fees with whomever else they're dealing with. So if I am listing your building and you're the owner of the building, you and I have a listing agreement. Now, if Jana comes along and brings a tenant and we work out a deal, I have a cooperative agreement with her. It's not with you, it's with me. So the concern would have to fall to me. Now, if I tell Jana I'm going to split a fee and I don't, then Jana's going to come after me in a heartbeat. And in the lease, particularly in the lease world, if you're not cooperative, you're not going to survive very long. I mean, everybody's going to know that in the brokerage community.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, we do have internal in the Realtor program a professional standards program to handle dispute resolution between brokers as well. So that wouldn't necessarily interfere with this.
Okay, thank you.
Awesome. Anything else? Representative Ackerman?
Yes, I just want to make one comment, and then I intend to make a motion. In partial response to Representative Prozonsky's idea about arbitration as a method to speed up the process, the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments save over 655 days in the process by shortening the time period for filing and the time period for filing the lien and for filing the foreclosure suit. My idea, again, being that lawyers and parties somewhat respond to deadlines more than they do the merits of the case, and seeing a shorter timeline would induce the parties to try to settle the case or clear the matter as quickly as possible. So I just want to state that for the record in response to Representative Prozonsky's statements. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will move that the Dash 1 amendments be incorporated within House Bill 2590.
Representative Ackerman has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2590. Is there discussion? Maybe on these we just ought to have Patsy call the roll, because I don't know how everybody, you know, people are going to jump off. I just soon sort of keep tabs so we know what we're doing here. So the Dash 1 amendments have been moved, and I've asked for discussion before the vote. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the Dash 1s will remove the timeline from 90 days to 45 days. Am I correct in that?
For filing the lien.
For filing the lien. And the advantage to doing that is?
Representative Ackerman.
The advantage of shortening all the time periods is to allow the parties either to settle or litigate the case at an earlier time to remove the lien from the property.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, and I suppose that having the shorter timeline could actually increase the likelihood of getting paid, because it's just going to bring this thing to a head sooner rather than later. So it may actually act as a motivator to the party who may be subject to a lien to get this thing paid and get it done quickly, as opposed to... If you give 90 days, typically this thing will happen on the 89th day. It'll get resolved on the 89th day. I mean, if you do 45 days, it gets resolved on the 44th, and just saved everybody a month and a half.
All right, Representative McPherson, you move to your mic.
I did, Mr. Chair, and this has been a difficult bill to kind of try to sort out and get it form an appropriate concept on. And the way I've looked at it is that it is really a counterpart to construction liens and the liens that we provide to people who make available to people who add value to property by the work that they do on that property. And my understanding of the shortening of time periods is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Ackerman, that this puts us in line with the mechanics of how those liens are handled in the construction context.
Those are 75 days. I'm sorry.
Well,
I looked at the statute and found the 120-day period for the construction or material maintenance liens. I was just looking for some basic symmetry. But I still am of the thought that if I hire a broker that leases my facility or sells my facility, that is adding value to the transaction just as much as someone did a repair on the property. So I saw some consistency there.
Yes, Representative, and that's the sort of the guideline that I'm following in my approach to this bill as well, that we ought to be recognizing that the value that's conferred by a broker on the property is akin to that value, and on that basis, I will support the Dash 1 amendments and in the other amendments here as well.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and call the roll, Patsy? And
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
No.
Representative Kermel.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Prezanski.
Voting no, reserving my right on the bill.
Representative
Kelly. Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
No.
Chair Williams.
Aye. The Dash 1s are adopted. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move that the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill be incorporated within House Bill 2590.
Representative Ackerman has moved the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2590. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
So once again, moving from 2 years down to 120 days is basically to expedite the litigation if there is going to be litigation brought because of non-payment of fees. Am I pretty much correct in that?
Representative Ackerman.
That's correct. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Korzenski.
Yeah. Representative Ackerman, I guess the only thing I'm not conceptually here, how is this going to move the matter to litigation quicker by just having the shorter times? Because there's nothing here that makes the court take this action or this cause before it any sooner than it's going to docket it based on whatever its resources are.
That's correct, Representative Prezanski. It doesn't consider litigation time, which is entirely speculative and something we can't control. It merely means that if the lien holder wants to foreclose on the lien, it must be done within 120 days rather than a two-year period. And that's where the shortening comes in. You save several hundred days in getting the case to court earlier with the idea you get an earlier resolution.
Okay.
Okay, Patsy?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Hart?
That was an aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Prezanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. The Dash 2s are in the bill. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move that the Dash 3 amendments to 2590 be incorporated therein.
Representative Ackerman's moved the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2590.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Crummell.
I have not had a chance to completely read through the Dash 3s, but my question is, do the Dash 3s, because it appears as though it's a it removes everything out of the bill and replaces it. That being the case, are the 45 days from the Dash 1s and the 120 days from the Dash 2s in the Dash 3s as well? To the point that I got in my reading, I hadn't got to that to them yet.
No, they're not.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Maybe Representative Anger. I see 90 days on page 2, line 14, and I see 2 years on page 4, line 15. So...
No. So,
I don't know that these necessarily speak to the Dash 1s and 2s.
No, there's a dissonance here.
It does look like that's the case, doesn't it?
Line 15 as well.
Could Mr. Chair, maybe Representative Ackerman could tell us what the dash twos dash threes are supposed to do?
Yeah, let me tell you what I thought. I wanted to submit all three amendments as separate amendments, knowing there was some diversity on the committee, and there might be some diversity within the public, so we could have a choice. I did intend that if the dash ones and twos were adopted, that those numbers would be within the main bill. I did not anticipate that they would not be incorporated within the dash threes, which evidently the dash threes don't reflect dash ones or dash twos.
But the fundamental purpose of the dash threes, as I understood your earlier comment, Representative Ackerman, was to limit the reach of the lien to simply leasing transactions and not sale transactions.
That's correct.
Okay. All right, so that's the fundamental purpose.
Mr. Chair.
I suppose procedurally what the dash ones and dash twos are amending the dash threes.
Right, it gets a little...
Yeah.
It gets a little dicey.
Yeah.
I think we can tell them what we meant but I think it's a little more complicated. Council?
We have this identical problem on a bill that is coming up on the Senate next week, and I talked to LC about that, and they said, well, we can, the two amendments, if they conflict, they will make a conforming amendment between the two of them. It's not precisely the same issue, but I think, seeing that it's just a number change, that would be relatively simple.
Should I amend the motion then to state not only to incorporate the dash threes, but to conform them to the dash ones and twos? Would that make a clearer record?
Yeah, you can make that. You can make that motion. So you want to, Representative Ackerman has amended his motion that the adoption of the dash three amendments conceptually. Amending those amendments to conform with the day changes that have been previously adopted in the dash one and the dash two amendments. So essentially it's the dash threes focusing on the issue of lease only and not sale transactions, but keeping with the 45-day and the 120-day periods that were adopted in the dash one and the dash two amendments.
That's correct.
Okay. Discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative McPherson.
I support this motion, and I guess I go back to the same framework I was describing earlier, that what we're trying, we're trying to accomplish here is to provide a remedy that is akin to the value that is added to property when somebody provides materials or construction services related to them. And as it relates to sale transactions, there is a whole other mechanism in the form of an escrow from which brokers get paid. And in my experience in real estate transactions, that works very effectively to get them paid. And that the purpose of this bill is to provide a remedy where there's a leasing transaction and there's no closing escrow. And so on that basis, I will support the amendment.
Anybody else? Okay, Patsy.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Brzezinski?
Aye.
Representative
Steadily?
Excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. The dash threes are in the bill.
Representative Ackerman? Yes, Mr. Chair. I will move that House Bill 2590, as amended, be forwarded to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves that House Bill 2590 as amended move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
For the record, I will support the motion at this point, but I'm reserving for hopefully talking to the opponents and proponents before the vote regarding the amendments that have come before us.
All right. Anybody else?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to support at this point too to get it to the floor, but I still have some waffling here about this. So.
Okay, anybody else want to waffle? Patsy, call the roll before anybody waffles.
Representative Barker?
Hi.
Jensen?
Waffle.
I even left off the prep, so
go fast. Hi.
Representative Crummell?
Maybe. Hi.
Representative McPherson?
Hi.
Representative Brzezinski?
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Wood?
Aye. House Bill 2590's amendment moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Ackerman, will you carry it with all those amendments?
Yes, I will. I'll keep those in my head.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, colleagues, we're now going to move to work session on House Bill 3344. Representative McPherson, and I'm looking for Mr. Monroe.
Yeah.
There they are. Jack, you want to come up? We, Mr. Chisholm.
What are we going to? 3344.
Oh, I think.
You want to take your. Oh.
I'm going to go.
All right, Jack.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Oh, you know what? I should start with the representative.
You
first.
Bet.
My apologies. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Williams, members of the committee, it's my pleasure to introduce, and it's really about the only function I think I'm going to perform here, to the Craig Chisholm, who's a constituent of mine and longtime friend from Scottish circles. He has a very talented son who plays wonderful pibrochs on the bagpipes, and it's a wonder to listen to, and I commend that to you at any occasion you have the opportunity. And Jack Monroe will be assisting as well on a bill that is pretty minor in its scope, but the purpose is to accelerate the movement of funds that are held in fiduciary accounts, particularly in title insurance accounts, into the Common School Fund and get them at work for the citizens of Oregon sooner, and to allow title companies to not have to carry these as long. And but it also has a potential impact on retirement plan accounts, so I'd be happy to speak to that aspect of the bill later, but I'll turn it over to the others here.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Let's go to Mr. Monroe for the caber toss.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Jack Monroe, here today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association, and you're absolutely right. It's unusual to see members of three Highland clans sitting before you, a Chisholm, a McPherson, and a Monroe. All of whom probably had ancestors that were hung for stealing cattle. But
and we appreciate, gentlemen, that you didn't kilt us today.
But that's another issue. Money is short. The state's looking for ways to infuse revenue, however small it might be, into state funds and use them productively. And as Representative McPherson has indicated, Mr. Chisholm has an idea, if you will, to infuse a little additional money, and that's really what 3044 is all about. Craig, take it away.
All right. Craig Chisholm, and I'm also with the Oregon Land Title Association, which is happy with this idea. And my perspective is from the standpoint of the title companies who also have escrow functions, and in those escrow accounts, sometimes there are various, usually small, but numerous amounts of money. Right now, the law is that after 5 years, we're supposed to turn those over to the state school fund. When they're turned over to the state school fund, if the claimant wants them, they can go back to the state school fund. Same issue is with us. If they were to come to us, they're not our money. We can't make any money holding them. That's not permitted by the state. It costs us money to hold them. It costs the state money to regulate to make sure that we don't run off with the monies. And we're sitting with something, as near as I can figure, something above $400,000 that would be freed up to the state and just move from our escrow accounts, where it's not drawing interest, over to the state, where it can draw interest for the state school funds. So I think we would be happy to get rid of the money. I think the state would benefit by getting the money. And I see no particular downside to it. Welcome any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Chisholm or Mr. Monroe or Mr. Representative McPherson?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Just one point. There are a set of Dash 1 amendments to deal with an effective
point,
date, and that we would obviously encourage you to include those amendments.
Look, Mr. Chair.
Can you explain again what the Dash 1s do, Jack?
Well, the intent, I mean, I think when you insert the word before on, it essentially means that there isn't a time when the new statute wouldn't apply. What we were trying to deal with here was that we didn't think it made any sense, let's say, to have funds that had become dormant, let's say, on the 31st of this year, escheat 5 years from now, when funds that became dormant on the 1st of next year, when the bill became effective, escheated in 2 years. So our effort was obviously to make funds that have been in our custody for 2 years, whenever they went into custody, subject to the provision.
And this speeds up the turnover of the money. This would that's the quantum of money that would be given immediately. Well, not immediately, but faster.
Representative Shetterly.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed the first part. Has someone addressed the opinion of legal counsel about the Dash 1 amendments?
No, I was just going to ask about that. Have you seen a copy of that?
Which?
The letter signed by Mr. Mills, staff attorney in the Legislative Council's office?
Yes, I saw that. I don't see, number one, I'm not sure that it really is an impairment of constitutional, of the Constitution to do it this way. But I'm not sure that there's any harm in it, in the sense that the monies in escrow are there because no one's asking for them. The monies are put over into the state land board funds, where, again, if anybody wants them, there they are. It's not as though anybody is prejudiced by moving from one pot to the other.
Right.
So I think it's whether or not there is a constitutional issue, it's a moot issue.
Okay. Questions? I want to bring up, when you three are done, Ms. Holman from the Division of State Lands, formerly of the Legislative Council's office, to put in anything on the record that they feel like they need to put in. Anybody? All right. Thank you very much,
Thank
Ms. Holman.
You.
Ms. Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jeanette Holman from the Division of State Lands. I'm the Assistant Administrator for Finance and Administration, and my section handles unclaimed property. We come before you to support this bill, and I would also support the Dash 1 amendments. These funds don't get turned over to us until they've been dormant for 2 or 5 years, which means that the holder of the funds hasn't had any contact with the person they have on record as being entitled to them for either 2 or 5 years. So I don't think there's a constitutional problem here. So that's my off-the-cuff comment on the Dash 1s. And it would certainly be an easier process for the division if it applied to everything, rather than having some questions about which ones come in and which ones don't. As in the past, we would always be willing to work with the holders if necessary to stagger them or bring them in earlier, whatever they need to do to comply. Okay. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Are there questions for Ms. Holman?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, just so I understand this statute, this doesn't relate to bank accounts. These are specifically funds held in a fiduciary capacity that are payable at the end of a period of time or on a specific event. So there's another statute that deals with other abandoned properties. Is that right, Jeanette?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, that's correct. In fact, the banking institutions, financial institutions, have their very own statute to address unclaimed property.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Counsel Joseph.
For the record, I had a conversation as well with LC, and I didn't see any constitutional concerns with the Dash 1s, and we tried to flesh out some of the potential arguments, but I'm not sure that there's any contract in the typical situation where that those funds are held by a fiduciary.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Anybody else? Thank you, Jeanette.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else here who wants to testify or talk to us about House Bill 3344? Okay.
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Yeah, no, I just want to follow on. It seems to me, yeah, that likely any contract liability would have been discharged at the date that the funds were payable, or at least on demand or claim of the beneficiary. And at that point, you're really kind of into overtime and beyond the term of the beyond the term of the fiduciary agreement.
Well, and to the extent that it doesn't foreclose a person from, once the transfer has been made, being able
right.
to lay claim on those funds,
right.
it doesn't seem like anybody would be impaired by it.
We also, if I might, we fleshed out the issue of would there be a situation where somebody is essentially waiting for, they were the finder of the property and they're waiting for nobody to claim it, but in this situation, all that property would go to the school fund anyway. There'd be no, they wouldn't be waiting in anticipation to claim such property. Nor would anybody be waiting in anticipation of the running of the 5 years. They'd be more likely to make their claim when it became ripe. So,
okay. All right. Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair, first, just might offer by way of explanation something that I didn't touch on earlier, but the deletion of the term for self-employed individuals in subsection 2 is an act of beautification of ORS. In fact, retirement funds are there's no significant difference between the treatment under federal tax law now of plans for self-employed individuals, which was not always the case. And I think that this language is a throwback to an earlier time. And and that's not a substantive change, is really to make it clear that the scope of retirement accounts that are affected by this statute is reaches the full range of both self-employed and corporate and other entity-sponsored plans.
Well, we're always happy to beautify the ORS. We live for that.
With that, I move, Mr. Chair, the adoption of the -1 amendments to House Bill 3344.
Representative McPherson moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 3344. Is there discussion? Objection? The ones are in.
Mr. Chair,
Representative McPherson.
I move House Bill 3344 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves House Bill 3344 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on that motion?
I'll just make one comment, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. I was thinking about objecting to the amendments based on the fact that our lawyers that we rely on for the legislature as a whole is legislative counsel, and they've sort of advised us that this could be problematic. I guess we can choose whether or not we want to take the advice of our lawyers as I read it. So I guess putting on the record that at this particular point, by putting the amendments in and by going ahead and passing the bill, we're choosing to ignore the advice of our lawyers.
Well, I think ignore, Representative Crumble, is probably a strong term. I think what they said is that
discount, maybe.
It is foreseeable that a fiduciary might have to act to forward property to the state before the fiduciary completes the duties under the contract. In our discussion, I think we've determined that while they raised an issue that they believe may be problematic, we have determined that it will not likely be problematic. So I don't know that we are ignoring them. I think we're just coming, after deliberation, to a different conclusion on the problematicness of the issue. How's that?
I guess that's fine.
All right.
Or maybe just a heads up for us to consider it when we're deliberating.
Yeah, which I think we did.
Mr. Chair, I think that falls under the law of two lawyers, two opinions.
You got to remember what committee you serve on, Representative Parker, and whether you want any more bills that have your name on it. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
I have some documentary proof of not two lawyers, two opinions, but four lawyers, two opinions, coming out of the same group that we are.
You guys have to remember what committee you're on. My goodness. All
but,
right.
Having said that, let me go back to my good friend, the Honorable Representative from Wilsonville's comment. On my personal life, with the professional people, if I don't like their opinions, I don't continue to retain them. I'm not going to continue to pay them when they keep telling me things I don't like, sort of thing.
I didn't know if you meant the opinions or the people.
Well, the people are, I'm paying for opinions. And
well,
so I have some concern that we, and on a serious note, I do have concerns that LC is giving us, one thing. I understand very well what the chair said, Mr. Chairman, but I would have to say that this would go against my personal practice. I'd have to dig deeper in it in my personal life.
And I appreciate that, Representative Jensen. Let me just say that I don't think that this letter was issued to say that what we were doing, in fact, created a constitutional problem. I think they gave us an appropriate heads up, and the sponsors of the bill an appropriate heads up to investigate the issue. And I think we've got a general sense from the committee and those who have some familiarity with this issue and those who work with it on a daily basis in practice that it's unlikely that the issue they raised would actually arise in the given circumstance. I don't think it suggests that the advice they gave us was bad. I think it was legitimate to have a conversation and to put the issue on the record, but I don't think it either speaks poorly either of this committee's action nor of the work done by Legislative Council Committee, and I'll put that on the record. Okay. Let's call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Krummel?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Prezonsky?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 3344 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative McPherson, if you would carry the bill. Okay, up at the top of the agenda, we're going to move, the chair would move that we reconsider the vote by which we passed out House Bill 3362. That bill passed out the other day, colleagues. There was some discussion among the people with concerns about that bill that there would be amendments. The committee moved on the bill before we were aware that there were potential amendments to the bill, and the chair has agreed that we would seek reconsideration to allow people to express their concerns about the bill on the record. So the motion is that we reconsider the vote by which we passed 3362 to the floor. Is there discussion? Objection? All right, the bill is reconsidered. I'll open a work session on House Bill 3362. And who have I got here from? I've got Mr. Powell. Do I have somebody here from the OMA? Yes. If you want to come forward as well. Mr. Bishop from the Hospital Association. Yeah. Okay. Bruce, we'll get you up next. All right, if we could, we're going to start losing people here relatively soon, so if we could just be as brief as possible describing the issue, and why don't we go ahead and start since the OMA brought the bill forward, if you want to start, and then we'll...
Thank you, Chair Williams, and committee members. My name is David Madigan. I'm with the law firm of Cooney & Crew, and we are general counsel for the OMA. I testified in front of the committee on Monday, so I'm not going to spend any more time regarding... my position and the OMA's position on the bill. I did bring Shirley Haig from OHSU Medical Group and Cami Laricero from the Salem Orthopedic and Fracture Clinic to briefly tell the committee about their experiences with the physician lien law in its current form today. And I'd like to give Shirley Haig the opportunity to tell the committee about her experience.
Okay, if you would, please.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, I'm Shirley Haig, and I'm with OHSU Medical Group, and my position is the legal customer service rep. One of the positions I have is reviewing and filing liens for the staff physicians at OHSU. With me, I have just keep this as brief as I can, but on several of the liens that we have filed, and I have been in this position since 1999, we very rarely receive any of the funds. I'd like to pass out just some little samples of some of the liens that I have done. There you go. Basically, what we're reading as the ORS regulation is that we have 30 days after discharge of a patient to file a lien. And this is just barely ample time because it does take a lot of time for the physicians who are in the ER to configure all of their charts. Then they go to a coder. Then they have the transcriptions done. And then I review them. And by that time, we have a charge fee for their services. So We have like 700 to 800 physicians at OHSU. Many departments can be involved. And so it's quite a bit of review on my part to do to file the lien. So the 30 days is quite ample for me to get a lien filed. My understanding is that all of the liens that are received should be pro rata, whether it is with the transportation teams, such as AMR, whether it's the hospital facilities, or with any of the staff physicians, anesthesiology, or whatever other providers would be included in that. As I stated many times, we do get this in a timely fashion. The first one that you see on here, the date of loss was on 3/14. The lien is actually on the second page. I filed it on 4/4. The patient was discharged on 4/1 of this year. We received no fines. And this was a common trend with all insurance companies. Our doctors really don't have much say in when something's going to be. Lots of times they don't know that they're going to even get paid. And on the PIPs, maybe this is all they're going to get is a pro rata fee. And so we have spent a lot of time filing a lien just to be ignored. And that basically is what my issue is.
Okay, thank you. You want to go next?
Chair Williams, my name is Cami Lucero, and I'm an administrator for a five-physician orthopedic practice. We are part of the Willamette Orthopedic Group, which has approximately 21 physicians that provide services here in the Salem area. I've come today to represent these physician groups who have unanimously concurred to the frequent challenges pertaining to the misinterpretation of the physician's lien law. The Oregon laws relating to medical services liens, when there are insufficient funds to satisfy in full the liens of all hospital and physicians, ensure making the payment shall prorate the available funds without regard to the sequence of filing. Imagine getting a call at 2 o'clock in the morning on a weekend. This is to a physician, obviously. The person on the other end of the phone has requested you immediately rush to the emergency room. There's been a tragic car accident and surgery is necessary. After hours of performing surgery, sometimes with the help of another surgeon, months ahead of future follow-up with this patient, then you are informed you will not receive pay for your time. Many times I've had to, with great regret, explain to my physician that due to the fact we are unable to file a lien till the following week, back to the interpretation of the insurance adjuster, first come, first serve, you will not receive pay. Now, not only has our physician spent enormous amounts of time and effort to perform a special skill with no pay, he or she is also open to the financial risk of future legal action if the patient is unsatisfied with the outcome. I'm very proud to work for physicians that will not let this misinterpreted bill discriminately sway their decision to help these patients in need. Because of their dedication to the health and well-being of these patients, I personally am more determined to help make the changes necessary to fairly and legally correct and enforce the interpretation of this law. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. With me is Mr. Merle, an attorney with State Farm. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the bill before you has is an attempt by the physicians to get a pro rata share of primarily PIP claims, although this applies to bodily injury liability claims as well. However, the problem that it gives the insurance companies is that this bill and the language appears to require the suspension of claims pending this period of time where the people who have lien rights can file their claims. Now, the examples you've been given have been given a little bit out of context. Take the serious automobile accident where somebody's in the hospital for 3 or 4 weeks. The period of time, 30 days, starts running on the day of discharge from the hospital, not the date of the accident. So the insurance company starts receiving bills. PIP was never designed to replace health insurance. PIP is a first-party coverage designed specifically to speed payment to providers so that the injured party is not harassed by providers. So the insurance company is in a position where the insurance division interprets one of their rules in such a way as to require the insurance company to pay any bill within 30 days. In fact, this very organization, the Oregon Medical Association, passed legislation last session requiring health insurers to pay bills within 30 days. The insurance division interprets this rule to require insurers to pay these bills within 30 days. So we could not live up to that requirement and this bill at the same time in some instances.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sheriff.
John, just help me. You said health insurance last session, 30 days. This is PIP and
right.
bodily injury.
Right.
So they're not necessarily inconsistent.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, they're inconsistent in that this is requiring slow pay.
Right, but I mean, technically, you're not to comply with one.
Well,
doesn't put you out of compliance with the other.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, no, not technically. However, there is a direct relationship with this problem and health insurance. Health insurers, in the case of an automobile accident, will not pay until they have received an exhaustion letter from the PIP carrier. Otherwise, they don't know what portion of the bills they're liable for. So the longer this goes, the fewer health insurance bills can be paid on a timely basis. And that may, in fact, run afoul of that statute. So that is indeed problematic. So we understand the issue well. We just don't believe that this is an answer. State Farm alone fields about 21,000 PIP claims a year. You can imagine if each file has to go into suspension according to a hospital discharge date, that where this would apply. And so administratively, it would be very difficult for us to suspend these files. And then you have the added problems that we've talked about in addition to this. So if there is to be a statutory scheme to resolve this issue, we would recommend one approach would be to allow parties who have filed legitimate claims to work out a pro rata sharing of that value in some process after the payments have been made. That way, the health insurer, the PIP insurer, can go ahead and exhaust their limits, give notice to the health insurer who can start paying claims, and there's no delay or no seam created in that system. And the two entities, the hospital and the doctor, can resolve on a pro rata basis their situation afterwards. Now, it's my understanding, been talking to hospitals a couple sessions ago when this section of the law was amended, that does in fact occur sometimes. I don't see a statutory scheme for that, but I think one could be set up.
Okay. Do you want to add anything?
For the record, Mr. Chair, Steve Merle, State Farm Insurance. I think John's framed the issue fairly well. It's rare that we're called it's kind of unusual that we're here for speed of payment. And I think what happens is hospitals are faster perfecting their paperwork and tend to get paid first before you have any bill or any notice from the physician. And so they're left in the health insurer net as opposed to collecting from the PIP insurance.
Okay. Questions for the panel?
I have a couple.
Yeah, Representative Trumbull and then Representative Sherrill.
If the health insurance kicks in when the PIP is exhausted, I'm not sure and now that you've reminded me of that, Mr. Powell, I'm not sure that I'm seeing the issue with regards to the providers and the hospitals, because and I don't know how long the hospitals and other providers of Salem Orthopedic Clinic, for example, are taking in turning their claims around. So from the time that the physician sees the patient to the time that the bill is sent out the door. But if once PIP is exhausted, the health insurance kicks in, I'm not sure I understand why there's an issue here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, As I understand the scheme, the PIP insurer would not pay. They would withhold payment through this lien period,
right,
which doesn't start until hospital discharge. So it could be some time.
Right.
So because they do not pay or exhaust, the health insurance would not kick in until that occurs. So you're delaying exhaustion of that underlying benefit, thus delaying the point at which the health insurer would start paying.
If I may, Mr. Chair, but I guess what I'm getting at is that, okay, the hospitals and the providers want to get paid for services rendered. I mean, we agree on that,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, very much so.
So that being the case, then if the health insurance company receives a PIP exhaustion, then they would start picking up the claims and paying for the provider's services.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, yes, they would request that letter.
And so my point is that the providers are being paid. So if PIP is exhausted, why does it make a difference? Maybe the providers can help me out here, why it makes a difference with regards to...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, I think it matters as to which providers get what amount of the PIP benefit. If there is a $10,000 PIP benefit and there is an $8,000 hospital bill and then comes $4,000 with the doctor bills, there may be $2,000 left above that limit. Now, in the case of health insurance, that those providers would get paid through that other bucket.
Right. But they also are paid under the contract rates versus being paid under the PIP rates, which the PIP rates may be paying at full fare, whereas the contract rates of the health insurance provider may be paying at 80%.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, I think you're generous if you say the PIP carrier is only paying at 100%. I think you're being generous. It's probably more than 100%.
Representative Shetterly?
No, I'm totally.
Well, I'm not sure I understand that last. John, if you could clarify that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, in fact, just a couple weeks ago, a hospital executive went over the cost shift in insurance programs when you count Medicaid, Medicare, commercial insurance. And I think the factor for hospitals that apply to commercial insurance is about 140%. In other words, in order to make up for the underfunding of government programs and the level they're funded at, there's actually an exaggeration of billing to private pay patients who have insurance, commercial insurance.
Mr. Chair, okay, no, I think I understand. You're talking about the cost shift. You're not talking about PIP carrier getting a bill for $5,000 and paying $5,080. You're talking about just what are the components of that $5,000 bill, or to what extent there's cost shift embedded in that. Okay. If I can ask my original question.
You may.
Well, I think I understand the problem as you've described it, but don't we also have a problem that whatever it is, it sounds to me like still the carriers just will have to ignore this statute because it doesn't work, isn't that? Because really, the statute really does seem to contemplate that all these claims would come in and then be prorated without regard to priority, without regard to which ones come in, the sequence of filing. And so it seems to me that, and maybe you're just in this situation because the statutory scheme doesn't work, but it seems to me you almost have to say you're ignoring this statute in order to be doing what you're doing.
Mr. Chairman.
And again, maybe for good reason, because it doesn't jive with other things, but I read the statute as contemplating these all come in, and then they are prorated without regard to sequence, which tells me you don't do it on a first-come, first-served basis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, if I understand what the proponents are trying to do in subsection 3 on page 1 of the bill, it changes from... The language changes from when there are insufficient funds to, on line 27, the amounts available under the limits of the insurance, as opposed to funds available. You're now talking about policy limits. You're prorating the limits of the policy, not the funds that are available.
So if the insurer had paid out $5,000 of a $10,000 policy limit, okay, there's $5,000 available. But this says amounts available under the limits of the insurance, which is $10,000 versus the $5,000. That's my understanding of what the proponents mean by this. Otherwise, all this is you're right. If that's not what it means, this is just a restatement of current law.
Right.
And, okay, so we're having to assume that's what they're trying to do.
We're gonna need to break here, and I still want to close this out, and I want to give Mr. Bishop a chance from the Hospital Association to put their issues on the record. Representative Przanski, did you have a question that you needed an answer to before we bring him up?
No, I've got a statement based on what Representative Shutterly says. To me, it seems that we can make this very clear that this says all claims on liens have to be held for the 30 days and then paid out. Okay. I mean, it seems to me it's a fairness doctrine as to. Some people are interpreting it first come, first serve, first in, first out, as compared to what I think the statute says right now, take them all in and then prorate it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Przanski, that's exactly what the OMA wants out of this bill, is that the liens are all collected, and then within the 30-day time period at the end, that everybody gets, all the lien holders get a fair piece of the pie, and that's it.
Well, let's thank you very much. Why don't we go ahead now and bring up Mr. Bishop? And Bruce, we'll ask you for your best effort at brevity, if you could.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I will be brief. The more I reflect on this bill, the more comfortable I become that it does very little. In terms of changing existing law. If, in fact, all the proponents want is a fair share of the pie, I think current law allows that, and the only thing that may be happening otherwise is the circumstance in which an insurer settles a lien in far less than 30 days before any physician can file the lien, and I guess I don't have personal experience in that area, but it seems to me that that's an unlikely circumstance to occur. So I think the bill does relatively little. We have no objection to either what we understand to be the current statutory scheme or even the amendments, because it seems to change little, if anything. If you desire to move the bill ahead with or without amendments, and we had understood that there were going to be amendments, but apparently none are being presented. At least we would ask that you consider an amendment to take out Section 2, because whatever this bill does doesn't seem to deserve an emergency clause.
Okay. And I have not seen any amendments, although I understood that there might be some as well, and none have been presented. Questions for Mr. Bishop? Okay, thank you, Bruce. Before I close the work session on 3362, is there anybody here who wanted to speak on it that hasn't had the opportunity? Okay, I'll close the work session on 3362. I apologize to those of you we didn't get to in this afternoon session of the committee. We will convene at 6 p.m. this evening promptly. I'd encourage members to be here. I understand that there is a governor's reception in the ceremonial office that will... if you want to get to, we'll have to occur between the time the floor session ends and we start right at 6 o'clock, and we'll try to be as prompt as possible. And again, we apologize for those of you who weren't able to.